that movie with me. He says it's sad. Is it Robin Williams? Yeah, now I've made things dark, haven't I? She's back there talking to me about it. I'm trying to think about the sermon, and she's talking to me about Robin Williams. All right, anyway. So one day Jesus gave his disciples we'll call it a pop quiz. It was a good time into his ministry, and, they should have known what was going on. They'd listened to him, they'd seen him, they knew enough about him to have, they should have been able to know, the truth about him. And so Jesus kind of gave him a pop quiz, about who he was. So Jesus goes up to his disciples and says, "Hey, who is it that people are saying that I am?" And the disciples, they talked amongst themselves, they thought about it, and they decided to go, and they said, "You know what, Jesus, hey, look, people are saying you're a prophet. People can't really decide on which one. You know, they think you're John the Baptist, or you're Jeremiah, or you're Elijah, or you're one of the other ones, but pretty much everybody knows that you're a prophet." And that was a pretty solid answer. I mean, there's a lot of significance there that we could talk about, but, you know, we'll move on, but that's a good answer. It's a good answer. But Jesus said, "Okay, so who is it that you say that I am? Everybody else says I'm a prophet, but you spent the most time with me. You know me. You've seen the most. You've heard the most. Who is it that you say that I am?" And again, the disciples kind of talked amongst themselves. And then Peter, speaking on behalf of the other disciples, said, "Well, Jesus, we believe that you are God's very own son, that you are the Messiah, and that you are here as the king of the world." And that, as it turns out, was exactly correct. That was a great answer. They aced the test with flying colors. Very, very good. And Jesus told them that this idea that he is the Christ, that he is God's son, he called that the rock that he was going to build everything else on. Okay? So everything we believe as Christians, everything that we know as Christians, everything we do, everything we say, everything we think, it all builds from that foundation. The very foundation, the bottom floor, the basement, if you would, of Christian thought and Christian faith is that Jesus is God's son. Okay? That is the very first thing. If you know nothing about nothing else about Jesus, if you are starting somewhere, that's where you start. Then, we're told, Jesus built the next step on top of that. The second thing you should know. The second stone on the foundation, if you would. And it's kind of a surprising thing that he told them. Here's what we read, according to the Gospel, according to Matthew, here's what we read in the Bible. Jesus was telling his disciples something new. We read, from then on, okay, right after this, from then on, Jesus began to tell his disciples plainly that it was necessary for him to go to Jerusalem, and that he would suffer many terrible things in the hands of the elders and leading priests and teachers of religious law. He would be killed, but on the third day, he would be raised from the dead. Now, if we think about it like a pizza, okay, the crust of the pizza is Jesus' godson. That's the bottom layer. If you don't have that, you don't have a pizza. But then the second thing that goes right on top of that, the sauce, if you would, or the second foundation stone, is this idea that Jesus began to tell them. He needed them to have the crust first. He needed them to have that very first idea first. But then he said, "Okay, guys, I'm going to be going to Jerusalem. I'm going to be killed by the religious leaders, and I'm going to raise on the third day." Now, for you and I, we don't seem to understand how this is surprising, okay? That's because we have a Bible. That's because we live in 2016. That's because the story of Jesus is available to us in any form we'd like at any point, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Okay, so to us, there's nothing surprising about Jesus, you know, being alive and then dying at the hands of the Pharisees and the Romans and then raising again. We know that. But if we try to put ourselves in the shoes of the people who lived it, this is incredibly surprising. I mean, for them, these ideas contradicted one another. If Jesus really was God's son, then how was he going to be killed? If Jesus really was the king, this Messiah, this Savior that God had promised for centuries, and he really was that, why was he going to be killed? I mean, it didn't make any sense. In fact, they argued with him, and that's weird because they had just said, "Hey, we believe you're God," which means this. They knew for sure, at least they believed for sure, that Jesus was God's son, that he was divine, but then they actually argued with him. I mean, can you imagine saying, I believe you're God, but then the next thing you tell me, I'm going to argue with? I mean, again, that doesn't make any sense. But it was so shocking and so, you know, knocking them off orbit that they didn't know what to do with it. But I think there's an underrated part of this that we don't think much about being surprising. And that's this. You see, Jesus didn't just say, I'm going to die and raise again. Jesus didn't just say that. He could have, and that would have been surprising enough. That would have been, you know, enough information. But Jesus actually got very specific. He said it's the religious leaders, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the priests, the temple workers. Those are the people who are going to have me executed. And again, to us, you know, on this side of history, in 2016, we're used to those guys being the bad guys. You know, there's like, you know, in all the movies about Jesus, those are the bad guys, okay? They are the villains of the story. But if you think about it back then, that doesn't make any sense. I mean, the religious leaders, these are the people who had given their entire lives to studying God. They'd given their entire lives to teaching about God. These guys were the kids who sat at the front of the class. Okay? These are the straight-A students. In fact, the word Pharisee actually means one who is set apart. Understanding that God's people are those who are set apart, a Pharisee is someone who is set apart from the people who are set apart. They're extra special. That's the way they saw it. We think of Pharisees as a bad thing because we know the whole story, but back then, a Pharisee was a good guy. That was a good thing. It was something to aspire to. It was something you wanted to be. Think of it like this, okay? Let's say the Cubs win the World Series next year. The people, I know, but the people who will be most excited for that are going to be the people who've had season tickets for like 30 years. Like, it would be really weird if a season ticket holder at Wrigley Field was upset that the Cubs are winning now. That would be weird. That doesn't make any sense. Okay, they've waited this long. You would think they would be most excited, right? That's like the Pharisees. The Pharisees, they were the ones who always talked about God. They were the ones who always studied about God and learned about God and prayed about God. These were the Bible-believing conservatives of their day. They're the people you would expect would be most excited at Jesus. They should have been the first ones in the crowds, the first miracle Jesus performs, the first time he feeds, you know, thousands of people, or he casts out a demon, or, you know, he heals the sick or whatever. The first time that happens, they should have been first in line. And the question for us, if we can slow the story down a little bit, and we can just kind of think through this, a question has to be asked. Why? Why were the Pharisees so against Jesus? Why were the Pharisees upset at what Jesus was doing? Why are the Pharisees the one that Jesus says, those are the guys who are going to kill me? I mean, the death and the resurrection, that's obviously the lead, but going a little bit deeper, Jesus identifies the people who are kill him are the most religious, the most conservative, the most biblically based people. Those are the people who kill Jesus. The question is why? And I think the answer most of us would give is that, well, they just didn't believe in Jesus. You know, I mean, surely if they had seen Jesus, if they had recognized who he was, if they had been able to recognize Jesus as his disciples had recognized Jesus, then surely they would have believed in him. Surely they would have followed him. It's a lack of belief. It's a fundamental misunderstanding of Jesus' was. I think most of us think that it's just that they didn't believe. And that's a logical answer, but I also think it's a wrong answer. In fact, I think the Bible tells us specifically, I think Jesus tells us specifically, that a lack of belief was in no way, shape, or form the problem for the Pharisees. One day Jesus, I think, illustrates this point when he's preaching in parables to the Pharisees. He's telling stories, and these stories have this point, and one day Jesus is telling this parable to the Pharisees, and he says, listen guys, okay, imagine a farmer who was hired, or a landowner who was hired some farmers to work his land. Okay? You've got the owner of the land, and you've got some guys working the land. He says, imagine that. That wasn't a hard thing for them to imagine, because that was a very normal practice in the ancient world, and is a normal practice today, where the owner of the land, he's the one who has all of it, and then he hires guys to work the land, and then at the end of the season, after the harvest, they harvest everything, they split the stuff with whatever they determined before they should split, and then they both sell out and make a profit. That's what they do. So Jesus says, imagine that that happens, and imagine that there's a vineyard. Imagine that there's these guys who are growing grapes, and the owner, he doesn't live in the town, he lives far away. And the farmers, they have these grapes, and they plant and they harvest, and they go all year. Now imagine if at the harvest time, when it came time to split the crop and sell it, if the owner had sent some servants to the farmers. And the farmers decided, you know what, we don't want to split this money, we worked for this. You know, the owner, he hasn't done anything. Why should we split our stuff? And so the farmers get together and they decide that they're going to have a revolt. They're going to have a rebellion, so to speak. And so the three servants that come, they decide to mistreat, okay? One of them they beat, one of them they stone, and one of them they just flat out kill. Jesus, imagine that happened. And he says, then imagine that the owner of the land, he hears about it. He'd be confused. Because they had an agreement. They had an agreement beforehand that they would take care of the land, they would raise the crops, they'd split it. It's not confusing. It's not difficult. He says, so imagine that the owner of the land decides, okay, you know what? Maybe the servants, they weren't the ones I should have sent. And so he decides to send his son. And that makes sense, because his son, well, he can speak for the business. The servants couldn't actually speak for the business. The son could renegotiate a new deal if he wanted to. And the son could actually speak for the father. The son could do all this. He is an extension. He is the right hand, so to speak, of the father and his business. Imagine that he sends his son. And the farmers get together and they say, hey, the son is here. That's the heir. If we kill him, there's no one to inherit this land. Once the old man goes, then this will be our land. And so what they do is they kill the son, and they decide that's what they're going to do. They'll keep the land for themselves. So Jesus tells this story. And he asks the Pharisees at the end of it. He says, listen, guys, question. You guys are smart guys. He says, if this was real life, if that really happened, what would the owner do? The Pharisees, I mean, they didn't have to think. They said, well, of course, the owner would come in with like an army and wipe all these guys out. You know, he'd have them put to death. He'd come in, you know, with the authorities, and he'd have these guys killed, and then he'd replace those guys with farmers he could trust. And Jesus said, yeah, you guys are right. You're dead on that. And he talked a little bit more, and Jesus told the Pharisees that, unfortunately, in his story, that the Pharisees represented the evil farmers. That the farmers, that these guys, that they had made themselves enemies of God. And he said the reason, not the least of the reason, I mean, there's obviously the servants that obviously means something, but in the past, but he said in the present, you know, God's son is here and you're mistreating him. You're disrespecting him. You're rebelling against him. And eventually, I mean, at this point of his ministry, they were well on their way to having him killed. Now, there's a lot of meaning there we could talk about, but there's a huge, massive red flag there that I think we sometimes miss, and that's this. In this story, the farmers specifically know that it's the landowner's son. And the way Jesus tells this story, the Pharisees know that Jesus is God's son. They know who he is. They know why he's here. In the story, Jesus tells them, listen guys, this is not a matter of ignorance. They do what they do willfully. They do what they know, knowing what's going on. The way Jesus told the story, the Pharisees knew who Jesus was. The religious leaders who had Jesus killed absolutely knew what they were doing. They knew who they were killing. So the question again then is why? If it's not that the Pharisees killed Jesus because of a lack of belief, why? Okay, they know who Jesus is. They believe that he's God's son, but they still kill him. That just makes it even weirder. There's a story, it's actually an account of Jesus' greatest miracle that actually gives us the answer as to why the Pharisees did what they did. And the greatest and most famous miracle Jesus ever did was when he raised his friend Lazarus up from the dead. Okay, that's a story I think most of us probably are vaguely aware of, but we'll talk about it a little bit. Jesus, one day, he short version is he there's a guy who's dead and he brings him back to life. And that's a really important story because the way we're told is that Jesus actually didn't just bring a guy back to life. He brought a guy back to life who'd been dead for 4 days. And there's a ton of significance there in him being dead for 4 days. And not the least of which we learn when Jesus actually goes, and if you can imagine it, there's, you know, the tomb, it was inside of a cave, and there was this stone that was in front of it. And Jesus, at this funeral, essentially, all these people are mourning. They mourn for a week after somebody died. And so all these people, you know, they're on day 4 of mourning, and they're all, you know, weeping and wailing and crying and all of that. And Jesus goes, and he says, hey, roll the stone away. Well, what happens is Lazarus' sister, she protests. She says, Jesus, man, it's going to smell terrible. You're going to overwhelm everybody here with this problem. And she was right. You see, there's significance in Jesus raising somebody from the dead after 4 days. And that significance is this. It makes it impossible to fake. Impossible. You can't fake rigor mortis. You can't fake decomposition. You can't fake wrapping up a body super tight in grave clothes. You can't breathe at that point, okay? Think about this. Most of Jesus' miracles, I'm not trying to say that he did, okay? I don't think that he did, but most of Jesus' miracles are really easy to fake. I mean, do you have any idea how easy it is for me to pretend like I healed somebody right now? Like, all I would have to do is, like, grab Jennifer and say, hey, pretend you're sick. I'll come over here and whack you on the head, and oh, you're back. Super easy. That's a 5-minute conversation. And now I'm a great healer. People do that. It's very easy to fake. It's super easy. Like, if I were to go to Eric and say, hey, pretend like you're demon-possessed. Like, have some Alka-Seltzer or something. You'll foam with the mouth. I can come over, whack him on the head, be healed. I can speak in some tongues, and here, he's good. No more demon. This stuff is easy to fake. Okay? Even the whole, like, feeding the 5,000... Like, we realize Jesus wasn't by himself. Like, we're taking it at his word that there was only one box lunch. Like, what if he just brought it like a truckload? He's got all these people following him. He's got all these women. They're rich. Like, these wealthy ladies, they've got all this money. They could have just brought the food in and hid it. Nobody knows. You've ever been to a concert with thousands of people? You don't know what's going on stage half the time. Everything Jesus did, super, super easy to fake. And I promise you that for a lot of people, they just thought Jesus was a fraud. And they just looked at him like, you know, we look at Houdini or, you know, another magician like that. Like, oh yeah, he's doing some good sleight of hand, but it's not really miraculous. But bringing back a guy who's been dead for 4 days, that's different. That's impossible to fake. Because if he wasn't dead when he went into the grave, you wrap him up in grave clothes where he can't breathe, you put him behind a rock where there's no air. If he wasn't dead for the first day, he's dead by day 4. And Jesus was out of town when this happened. He's out of town when the guy dies. He's out of town when they bury him. There's no way this is a plant. So when Jesus shows up, okay, on day 4, and again, it's gross, but the guy's begun to decompose. It smells bad. And Jesus brings the guy back to life with just his words and his will. I mean, that's a miracle that's impossible to fake. And so it's no surprise that after Jesus raises Lazarus from the dead, all sorts of people begin to believe in him. People who before may have been skeptical, they're not skeptical anymore. I mean, that's impossible to fake. And the Pharisees knew that. Here's what we read in the Gospel according to John happens after the raising of Lazarus. It says, then the leading priests and the Pharisees called the high council together. What are we going to do? They asked each other. This man certainly performs many miraculous signs. If we allow him to go on like this, soon everyone will believe in him. Then the Roman army will come and destroy our temple and our nation. A little later this says, from that time on, the Jewish leaders began to plot Jesus' death. Here's a massive, giant, crazy idea. The religious leaders, the Pharisees, they didn't kill Jesus because they didn't believe in him. In fact, they killed him because it was no longer deniable that they should believe in him. As soon as they get that airtight evidence that everybody starts believing in Jesus, that's when they decide they have to kill him. You see, the Pharisees don't kill Jesus because they don't believe in him. They kill Jesus because they do believe in him. And because they're afraid. You see, the answer to our question of why did the Pharisees kill Jesus is fear. They believed in Jesus, and they were terrified of what that meant. Now, some of that was just kind of personal, okay? They were the guys in charge. They say that our temple will get destroyed. What they meant by that was not so much just the temple will be destroyed, but we're talking about like their entire way of life. We're going to talk about that way of life over the next couple of months here. But they had an entire way of life, an entire religious system, an entire religious order that was wrapped up around them. With Jesus here, they would lose that. And they were afraid of that. They were afraid of losing power. They were afraid of losing the sway they had in the world. They were afraid of that. But then they were also afraid of something else. There's another, every bit as legitimate fear that they had, and they were afraid of Rome. And this makes sense. I mean, they lived in a real world. Okay? This was not a game. This was not a movie. Okay? This is not just a story. This stuff really happened. And they lived in an empire that would kill you for anything. The Romans don't care who you are. The Romans don't care what, you know, if you're God's, if you claim to be God's son. The Romans claim to be divine. The Romans would have killed these people. And they said our entire nation will be destroyed if Jesus does this. If people believe in Jesus, we're going to have a war on our hands. Here's the facts, guys. The Pharisees killed Jesus because they believed in him, but because they were afraid of him. Their fear was greater than their faith. And their belief actually fed in to their fear. Their belief in Jesus was fuel for the fire. It was the wood. It was the coal that went into the embers of their flame. Their fear was the result of their faith. At the heart of the Pharisees, at the heart of God's enemies are not people who don't believe in God. It's people who do believe in God, but whose fear is what drives them. And now I've got to stop talking about people 2,000 years ago, and I've got to start talking about us. Because we may not live in Rome, but man, there's a lot to be afraid of. There's a lot, as people today, there's a lot of things we could fear that could lead us around by the nose. And if at the heart of a Pharisee, at the heart of an enemy of God is someone who believes in God, but who is afraid and who allows their fear to lead them, then I gotta be honest, there is a massive, massive danger for us that we could become just like them. Because there's a lot to be afraid of. I mean, in our world today, I mean, we've got a lot, I mean, there's terrorism. I mean, it's called terrorism for a reason. It puts fear in people. There's an economy. I mean, I tell people every day they're afraid of the economy. They're afraid of what happens if they lose their job or if the stock market goes somewhere. I don't understand the way the stock market works, but from what I understand, it's never stable. An unstable economy that we live in. There's a presidential election coming up. I'm just trying not to talk about it much, but I do know this. I have not met a single person who is not terrified at what might happen. Everybody assumes that if the person they're not voting for gets in, they are terrified it's the end of the world. I mean, we have so much to be afraid of. We have what's in our food. I don't know what's in our food. Like, if you try to read the labels of what's on that, like, it's these giant names we can't, I have no idea what's going on. Like, I have no idea what our kids are eating. If you're a parent, you have no idea what your kids are doing online. Like, that's scary. That is terrifying. There's racism that won't go away. There's bigotry. There's bullying. There's your pressure to keep up with your neighbors. They're all buying new stuff and you're trying to figure out how do I buy that new stuff. And there's a new holiday and every holiday you gotta buy new stuff. And then there's birthdays and there's this and there's that and you gotta keep up with everybody and that's terrifying. And then we go into debt, and then, oh my gosh, well now I can't sleep at night because I got all this debt, and so we have all of this. I mean, there is so much to be afraid of. And maybe the worst thing, I mean, the thing we can all agree on is this massive fear is I don't know if I'm ever going to know the end of Game of Thrones. Like the guy who writes those books, that guy's old. Okay? He's got 2 books to write. I don't know he's got 2 books in him. The guy writes like 1 book every 10 years and he's in his 70s. I mean, with all due respect, how will we know? Guys, there is so much in our world that is terrifying. And like when I was younger, I never really thought about it too much. I was like, oh, whatever. But as I get older, it's more and more and more. And so more and more and more, you find Christians whose faith doesn't free them. Their faith doesn't lead them to a better way of life. It doesn't lead them to more love. Their faith doesn't lead them to care about more people or to be tolerant of more people or to be more empathetic towards people or more understanding to people. It just leads them to be terrified of everything. And guys, the Pharisees believed in Jesus. They knew he was God's son. They talked about it. They said, all right, look, after this miracle, there's no denying it now. Everybody's going to believe in this guy. What do we do? The answer should have been, let's line up and follow him. But instead, they said, he threatens our way of life. He threatens our religion. He threatens our national security. It's not safe to follow Jesus. So from then on, they plotted to kill him. Guys, we have been given an invitation by Christ. And it is one or the other. It is faith or it is fear. You can believe in Jesus with all of your heart. But if you live a life that is based on fear, then you're going to be like a Pharisee. And you will oppose what Jesus is doing in his world every step of the way. The New Testament tells us that story. Okay? This is not an optional thing, you know, you can believe in or not believe in. This is not an opinion. Jesus said the ground floor is that I am God's son. And the next rock on top of that, the sauce on the crust of the pizza, is that there's people who will believe in me, be afraid of me, and kill me. We're beginning a new series this week. It's called Preaching to the Enemy. And for the next couple of months, we're going to talk about Jesus preaching and Jesus' interaction with these people that he knew were going to kill him. These guys who should have been the most excited people of all that he showed up, but instead were the people who opposed him every step of the way. And we're going to talk about exactly, specifically what some of that looks like and what some of those behaviors, what some of those ideas and attitudes that they had, how we can avoid having them in our world, and so we're not actually opposing what Jesus is doing. But as we lay the foundation, okay, as we introduce this whole idea, the lesson we have to learn, and it's hard, and I get it, and it's super easy to say and super hard to live out, but it's something we have to remind ourselves each and every day, and that's this. We have a choice between faith and fear. We can't choose both. Our first lesson from Jesus preaching to his enemies is this. Jesus invites us to choose faith in a world that is filled with fear. Let me say that again. Jesus invites us to choose faith in a world that is filled with fear. We get this morning the clip from Hook. That's right. I keep comparing Jesus to Peter Pan. I swear I'm done for a while. But in this movie, Peter Pan is Robin Williams. He grew up and got old and had kids. Okay, so he goes back. So Robin Williams, he goes back to Neverland because his kids get kidnapped, and Captain Hook, who's Dustin Hoffman, he wants to have one more fight, but he doesn't even remember this. He has no idea, and so at first Robin Williams looks absolutely nothing like Peter Pan, and so at first the Lost Boys that he's supposed to be leading into this battle, they don't accept him. They have no idea who he is. They can't figure out what this old man is doing. And so they almost all of them oppose what Robin Williams is doing. But here's the thing, okay? Because it's a movie and it's a story and it should make sense, as soon as the Lost Boys know that that's Peter Pan, as soon as he's flying around and crowing and doing all that stuff, they decide they're going to follow him. And the guy who was the leader before gives him back his sword and they go fight. I dare say that the Lost Boys were infinitely more reasonable than the Pharisees were. The Pharisees see that Jesus is really God's son. They know who he is. They hear about his miracles. They hear about his preaching. They see, they witness with their own eyes in some cases. They hear secondhand that Jesus raises a guy from the dead after 4 days. And they know he is God's son. The Pharisees believed in Jesus, but their fear was bigger than their faith. And so just like the evil farmers in Jesus' story, when the son came, they killed him. Guys, you and I have a choice. And it's hard, and I get it. I understand, like, everyone's yelling on TV all the time. Everyone's yelling online all the time. I get it. Okay? There's legitimate, real things to be afraid of in our world. But if you, as a Christian, if your faith doesn't make you more courageous and more bold, if your faith doesn't make you more loving and more caring and more empathetic and more gracious and more willing to work with people who aren't like you, then you've gotten your faith in Jesus wrong. Your faith in Christ should bring us to a place. And here's why, because the Bible tells us that love casts out fear. And that means if we live our lives surrounded by fear, if we are drug around the nose by the things we are scared of, we are not being motivated and led by fear. Fear and love cannot coexist. Love casts out fear. And so what we are called to do is to believe and to trust and accept the fact that we are told that the one who lives in us, the spirit that is within us, is greater than any spirit in the world. And come hell or high water, we don't know what's going to happen in the future. We don't know what's going to happen in our world. But at the end of the day, we're not going to be people of fear. We're going to be people of faith. And it may not always make sense. It may not always be the thing everybody else is doing. It may not be what the people on TV are shouting about. But we're going to be people who follow Jesus. His teachings, his understanding, his ethics, what he taught and what he believed. You see, at the end of the day, believing in Jesus is not enough. The Pharisees believed in Jesus. There's another writer in the scriptures who tells us that the demons believe in Jesus. It is one thing to believe in Jesus. It's a whole other thing to accept Jesus. And the invitation Jesus has is for those of us who believe in him to accept and to trust that he is more powerful than anything else in our world. And so while we may be tempted to be led by our fear, we will instead be led by our faith. So when the musicians are going to come forward, they're going to sing a song. We give this an invitation every week. The Bible teaches us that each time a person decided that they were going to follow him, that they were going to accept, that they were going to believe, that it was going to be more than just a belief, but it was going to be an acceptance. That every time that happened, that they repented and were baptized. To repent is to turn their back on who they used to be. It is to say, I'm going to do things God's way. I'm going to accept this faith. In a world of fear, I will accept this faith. And the Bible promises, it's not a command. It's not a do this or you're going to hell. That was never Jesus' style. But the Bible promises that when we are baptized, there's a change that happens. A spiritual reality that is shown in that physical symbol. We go down in the water, it's like our old selves being put to death. We get out of the water, it's our new selves being born again. And we're promised. Our sins are washed away. We're given a spirit greater than the world's. And we're God's. If you've never made the decision, nice warm baptistry, lots of people who can do it, let's talk. If you're an immersed believer in Christ looking for a perfect church home, this is not it. But we do serve a perfect God. We want to connect, call, and cultivate. We want to meet new people. We want to share the gospel and grow up while we do it. The world is a scary place, and I'm not pretending like it's not. But our faith tells us that what we have is greater than what we're afraid of. And if we can't get a grasp on that, we will never be more than Pharisees. As we stand and as we sing.